You're listening easy to smooth sailing with your captain, Jackson Scanberg, only on WJEB Radio, Milwaukee's finest classic country music, with special guest,
Hans Schroeder. Welcome, everyone, to Smooth Sailing on WJEB Radio 101.1 FM. It is a beautiful, slightly snowy day out in Milwaukee on February 5th, 2022. I'm here with Dr. Hans Schroeder. Hans, can you talk?
Oh, yes, quite. By the way, you promoted me. I with all my long time... due to the war and all the problems that in my life, I never got to the PhD, which everybody now has, but I'm an old timer.
That you told me earlier that you started taking tech courses at the Milwaukee School of Engineering back in the 50s.
Absolutely.
How did earning a tech degree work back then?
Well, really, I didn't have much of a plan. You see, when I ended up in the U.S., rather unusual circumstances, and also I didn't have a citizenship as a result. That was a problem later on. Because all the fellow graduates at the time when I had the B.S., they all got shipped out to the West Coast or interviews, aircraft companies, and I didn't because I was not a citizen at that time. But anyway, so when I started, of course, I didn't really know what I could do. I mean, it's a different country and never know what happens. So I signed up for the radio television technician course, especially because I was working for a little company, Wisconsin Sound Equipment Company, installed sound systems, repaired movie projectors. Mm-hmm. Remember movie projectors? 60 millimeter type. Anyway, that's where I was working, and I thought, well, I ought to do a little bit more. My education was incomplete because of the war, so I signed up to MSUE, seeing what they could do for me. Well, and yeah, anyway, go ahead. You had a question.
That was in 49 is when you began work.
Correct.
Studying at MSUE?
That's right, yes.
And what were the types of courses they offered back then? So well, what was...
This similar in a way, except that in the basement of the B building, which isn't much used at the moment, but at that time it was one of the principal buildings, had labs down in the lower level. Mm-hmm. And also then in the there was a if you want to call it that, generously, a cafeteria. So everything was quite primitive because really the old Karl Werwath was really building up the institution. And he did a bang-up job, really, but he had very little to start with. He had the support of guys at Allen Bradley. So, anyway, he had ideas, and he managed to realize them, but was really going upstream and fighting the established education institutions because they didn't like a newcomer.
Was Marquette and UWM already as large as they currently are back in the 50s?
So in fact, Marquette might have been more prominent, actually, relatively speaking, and UWM didn't really exist that way. It was Wisconsin State Teachers College, and of which my wife, late wife, had graduated. And so UWM came into existence later. So that was still before it was born. It was Marquette, and UW Extension is what it was at the time.
Okay. And you mentioned that on campus there was a building called the B building, and I know you also talked about the C building, which is that where the cafeteria was?
No, the B Broadway building, that's the one that still exists, except it isn't used by MSUE at the moment, or at least indirectly. But the C building doesn't exist anymore. That was called the Center building. That was really where the president's office was and everything. And also some classrooms facing Milwaukee Street. So that's was replaced where the current new construction is. That's about where that was sitting.
How large was this building? Was it as large as some of the buildings on campus right now, like the new
center? No, everything was quite modest. And the expansion later on was expanding into the church, which was at the corner of State Street and Milwaukee Street. It also is gone, of course. And we actually used that for an auditorium for quite some time. Then a lot of the motors labs were on facing the non-existent street that is really, that was in the middle of the block. You know, there was an east-west street, what's the name of it there, and that is gone now. But we had a motors lab there. And
So campus was still just a couple blocks even back then.
Smaller because Blatz was there, you know. Blatz was in full operation. So that all buildings that you recognize now, I mean, were part of the Blatz operation. And MSUE was, we figured that in due time Blatz would swallow up MSUE. And opposite, as they say, man bites dog.
Yeah, we have our alumni center was a building they owned, and their big building
our
across
campus center too.
Yeah, by
you
campus.
Remember when
center.
The campus center was still bottling beer?
Do you remember
back in the day when the campus center used to be the bottling plant for Blatz?
What they call the center building had been the Jewish center before that, and they gave it up and built a new one on Prospect Avenue, and then MSUE took that one over.
And what were some of the classes that they offered with the limited buildings in the first years, well, around that time?
Well, first term was DC circuits, and interestingly, what we used, of course, O'Shea wouldn't like anymore, because we used the AC power line and with light bulbs and some resistors that got pretty hot, stuff like that. You know, a lot of things that. But the idea was, you better learn to cope with it. It's the real world. So,
who taught these courses? Because electrical engineering was just emerging back, well, as we know it, is what I mean, at the turn of the century. So were some of your professors like the pioneers of electrical engineering as we know it?
Well, it was a full profession with lots of work to be done. And it's just totally different now, you might say. It's just things have shifted so much. All the semiconductors totally revolutionized everything that we were doing then. I mean, it was, for example, we had the in the D building, so-called, which was along Milwaukee Street and at the cross street. We had the Motors Lab, and that also was something at O'Shea, which just absolutely split a gut these days. Well, it was useful, and then we had series and shunt motors and all kinds of things, and ran conversion from AC to DC and made up, in effect, mechanical oscillators by motors and generators with the inertia driving the other one. And so it was really kind of fun with sort of 1 hertz or 0.5 hertz oscillators between these motors and generators. So the stuff that was important at the time. Motors have changed so much since then. At that time, there were series motors and shunt motors, and then AC induction motors. So those were the varieties that we studied.
And you became a professor at MSUE after you graduated. Was that?
No, after quite a while, because I really had never had that in mind. But after I graduated, I worked at the NCR in National Crash Ridge. At the time, it was in Dayton, Ohio. And I was the first one that was there, and they liked me. And so after a while, they hired an awful lot more people from MSUE, to the point that I said it was a little bit too much, because if you don't have enough variety, you know, a research division is not, it's too one-dimensional. I actually stopped further hiring. There were enough people there that Carl Werwath visited the Alumni Center in Dayton, gave us a speech and so on. So there were that many people at NCR that I was the first one, and ultimately they all drifted in. You know, I mean, we hired more people. In fact, they sent me back to MSUE to interview some new prospects and so on. Well, they liked the product of MSUE after the first experiment. I was the first experiment.
And how long did you stay with them?
It's about, I think about 10 years. I'd have to look at my own bio right now. I think it was 10 years or 15 years. That's right, because about that time, then in fact, you could look it up, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at that time, my wife, who had also worked at NCR, establishing the library there, the technical library, and she felt uncomfortable and wanted to be back in Milwaukee. So it was until about the Cuban Missile Crisis that we were in Dayton. And then I came back here, and I worked at Astronautics and other places. And then by and by, I mean, Astronautics was, well, very hectic, and I lost an awful lot of weight. And really, it was, about the best way to say it, hectic. And so my wife said, you know, that isn't good for you. She didn't like what was happening. And at MSUE, they were happy to have me back to or in their faculty. So that was, sort of looked up some of the dates. I could have given you better numbers, but anyway, I graduated in 65, and about 65, we came back to Milwaukee, and about 70 or 75 or so, I worked at Astronautics, and then came back to MSUE in due time.
One of my friends had a question for you. He was wondering if you saw the dedication or opening of the library building on campus.
Yes, that's right. That was when President, Ford, came for the dedication. Yes, that's right. And I remember all the Secret Service guys around checking waste baskets to make sure there was no explosives in it or whatever, securing the building and so on. You know, it was quite an event. You know.
Mm-hmm. So when you came back to Milwaukee, had campus changed a lot or was there any major surprises? What was it like?
Well, not too much. They had built the C building at the time, you know, also the this monstrous concrete structure, the shielding for the this cyclotron that never ended up being installed there. In fact, they're still fighting that the thick walls, though they are, it's too expensive to even cut a door into it. And if you go down there and look at it, you know, you see the thickness of that concrete. It was installed with different ideas because it would have been the only installation around Wisconsin to X-ray large castings. And that was what Karl Rohrwacht's idea. We have a kind of a monopoly practically on that. And anyway, right now there's a block of concrete there that is really in the way, but there it is. So when you walk in the building, you can take a look and see the thickness of the concrete that they cut the doors into.
Mm-hmm. I also know, like, when they finally redid RWJ this year, Roy Johnson Hall, they had to spend, it was so expensive. Most of the budget, from what I heard, was just getting the asbestos removed from the building.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I never thought about that, but of course that was standard building material.
Yeah. It's, you wonder what's in the old buildings and how much it would cost to build over them or construct new things in them, because not only do you have to get the material out of the way, you need to look what the material was even made out of. See if OSHA would like that.
And yet people lived with it then too, you know. I mean, it's nice to avoid things and to do the right thing, but on the other hand, it doesn't deserve to be deserve quite that kind of panic. So.
And what were your favorite classes when you were a student here? What did you do after, and like, how did it take you? You keep mentioning your passion for radio classes.
Yeah, that was really, of course, the thing when I first signed up for the radio television class. And then, as I say, at the end of that, I did well and I had established a grade point record. And so Karl Rohrwacht said, you know, it would be a waste. You got to continue. And so I came back and I caught up with a few courses. But other than that, it was always interesting. I was always interested in the subject matter. And of course, I kind of forgot the gist of your question, but get me back on the track.
I have a follow-up to that, actually, which would be, since you started taking these television courses in around, I believe it was 1954, is what I read.
Right.
What was it like to watch the evolution of television sweep the nation from 54 up until, I don't know, until 70s, where everyone had a television?
Well, I guess I'm not sure what to say. It's just a growth process. I remember in the early days when the first color televisions came around, I happened to be visiting in Milwaukee, and we walked over to an appliance store on Plutonia Avenue where they had one in the window, and crowd of people watching it, because that was the first. Was kind of a complicated system to stick the collar in with the other system, with the system that had been there, the black and white system, but they managed to put it all in the same bandwidth. So it was interesting, but of course, and Yeah.
I guess, could you explain the first televisions a bit more in depth, color televisions, of course, and why they were so complicated, if If you could, briefly.
If you like what?
Could you explain, just give a brief explanation of why it was so difficult for the first television, first color televisions to come around? You said...
It's trying to put some more information in with the same channel. You know, the 6 megahertz channel, and of course you have more information there. So that was probably the main thing, is squeezing that information, because you also have to make sure the color doesn't start wandering and people's faces get green, because you're not synchronized on the color signal. So it was superimposing something, kind of a clever bit of mathematics and engineering to do that.
So the FCC didn't allow for bandwidths to expand when color television started coming along?
No, still it was sticking in the same 6 megahertz channel. So that was the problem. You know, put that additional information, that additional signal in without using up more spectrum space.
Did that ever change, or did we just continue? Did the technology just continue to get better so that it did use less and less?
No, that was just a major change to the current system. That's right. In fact, the old sets are useless, really. Besides, I mean, about that time came the cathode ray tube was went out of use because of the displays we have here. In fact, when I was working at NCR, we were thinking of working on different displays. That was about the time that people were searching for other kinds of display. And so that was a major change from the cathode ray tube. Even when I was working at Astronautics, I had contact with some rather specially made cathode ray tubes for use in the F-111 aircraft. And that was quite an experience too. One time traveling at 3 a.m. on the aircraft, on the airplane, holding the tube in my lap to bring it back to Astronautics, Milwaukee here. Yeah.
What did you do at NCR? What were some of the activities or common projects you would have to do for them? Do you remember?
I worked in the research division, and it was really rather free form. We tried to make better magnetic cores. At that time, these 80,000.08-inch ferrite cores were thought to be the solution for memory. And we would worked a lot on the making ferrite of ferrous oxide Fe2O3 and with other additions to make a very square hysteresis loop, because a square hysteresis loop allowed better selection for the X and Y wires driving, so that only the core at the sum of the wires would activate and the other ones would ignore the pulse. So it was really for building some of those making some of those core planes, they actually hired did that in some of the Indian reservations where women were familiar with beadwork, and they did a good job in stringing those beads on the for the magnetic memory planes. So this is all early days of computers, and my 100K of memory was just way out of reach. Here we got terabytes now.
Yeah. Petabytes soon. Petabytes are coming. Yeah. But, I mean, even the fact that you had to hire people to weave them together is something that is probably even unheard of today. I mean, we have machines that can automate something as simple as the weaving process.
Yeah, except that in this case, you know, the topology requires that it goes through. That's the way magnets work, you know, magnetic cores.
Yeah.
So that was unavoidable. Now, we did experiment with printed wires, but that never worked out very well. So the magnetic cores are just, the magnetic field likes it that way. No, so that was difficult. And things have changed so drastically. It was fascinating what all happened. I spent a few weeks at MSOE, at MIT, when at the early days of some of the computer courses, so NCR sent me up there, and some of the new techniques came around, it was very interesting there and fascinating. So anyway, there's nobody quite knew in what direction the development of computer components should go, because everybody was experimenting. We at NCR, for a while worked with so-called ELPC, electroluminescence and photoconductor. And because the idea was that both of those could be in powder form and thus could be silk screened onto a substrate. So, and we did make flip-flops that way and bistable circuits that with electroluminescent phosphor and cadmium sulfide photoconductor powder. So, but anyway, ultimately, germanium won the race. So, and even that, you know, we also, in one course I took at MIT or in sessions I attended about superconductivity, which was considered to be another possibility for doing computer logic. Of course, the problem there is that just being built at room temperature, but you put it into liquid nitrogen and something colder than even the 77 degrees Kelvin. So the temperature shock caused a lot of unreliability. And of course, if you got a million components and one of them fails, you got a problem. So the failure rate was low, but it's way too high to be useful. But that was, people are working pretty hard on the superconductivity at one time, hoping that this would be a solution. Turned out that ultimately germanium was the answer. And of course, nobody would have thought of taking a slice of silicon now with these minute components, you know, invisible components on it. I mean, that's, of course, a more recent development. Just, you know, they talk about how many per, but the density of components is unbelievable.
Yeah, really is.
What we were thinking about at the time.
And I also know that you have patents to your name, correct? You have patents to your name, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did you get those patents, and what were they? What did you develop?
Well, that was in the research division at NCR, and one of them is the electrolytic storage. I have the model right here. And that's plating copper onto the end points of the platinum wire. And then when it gets deplated and it gets to the end, the voltage rises because the resistance increases when the copper is all gone off the platinum edge. So that was the way to store by reading out the length of time or deplating it with a constant current. So anyway, the old patent model that we that they made, and they gave me one.
And what?
What was the other one? I even have copies of the patent. Researching too much in my filing cabinet. I got copies of the patents, but anyway, and the other one was the electrolytic memory, and what was the other one? You hear talking, it wipes out my memory, but besides, I'm 92, so I mean, that's my excuse. Neither one of the patents is in use anywhere. I mean, it has been long passed by.
Oh, Mr. Bilkey had a question, I believe.
I have two. I've thought of some things while hearing Hans speak. So first, you mentioned Carl Weirwath a lot. Did you know him well? He was the second president.
Really. I mean, he's in charge, and then passed away in due time. But probably the person most in my memory is Fred Van Zeeland. And actually, I made sure when I donated something to the MSOE, the new building, to have his name on the EE department office door. And that's the one. And then I couldn't avoid his brother, Bill Van Zeeland. We used to call him Mad Bill, because he was just a genius, and you couldn't keep up with him. And so, Fred Van Zeeland was a real first-class professional type of person, and a wonderful speaker. He could cause people to be hit on the edge of their chair, and no matter what kind of a subject he was talking about. He was a spectacular person. So, and a very professional, very. I remember him, one of the little memories, when the new non-silver coins came around, and I remember him handling a dime and says, "What's happening to our money?" You know, it's kind of, because it's the general inflation and so on. So we, I mean, I worked for $1 an hour one time, and lived on it. Lived at the YMCA downtown at the time. So nobody would think of $1 an hour now. So anyways, the dollar has changed a great deal.
Sure.
General
How much did it cost you to study at MSOE then?
$125 for a quarter, and that was expensive. You know?
Mm-hmm. So,
and then I think the second or third term they raised it to 150, and I wonder whether I could make it. So it's just besides my first car I bought, of course it was quite a wreck, but anyway I drove it. Was $65. And the first one is Willys, a 1936 Willys for $35. And I needed to crank that, because that the starter wasn't working anymore, but it had a crank. So I right on Wisconsin Avenue, I stalled the car. I was a new driver, and I remember the kind of people being surprised when I ran out with my crank and got the engine started again. The olden days. That was before I was a student at MSOE, but so it was about two years after I came to this country.
When did you come to this country?
At the very end of 1948.
Mm-hmm.
We There was a law at the time called the War Fiancé Act, and that was really intended for GIs that maybe had promised marriage to a girl or something, and of course they would have taken years to ultimately for them to immigrate. And, so there was that law which expired right at that time, and it, in a way, my brother, who by the way ended up graduating from West Point, and and my sister in Santa Barbara, and so on, we all of course came along, and it, the law wasn't really intended that way, but Cloyd P. Schrader, Major Schrader, whom I had met by chance, he arranged, and we came under that War Fiancé Act just about the day that it expired. It was at the end of 1948, expired. So we made it, and then later on I had some problem with getting to be a legal immigrant. I mean, they used to check that more than they do now. Mm-hmm. At one point, the Heinz Werwath, who was the vice president, told me, you know, there's a U.S. Marshal looking for you. And so I said, you know, of course, and of course, I looked for him myself, you know, and talked to each other. Well, he arrested me for being illegally in the country because it was an unusual situation. So I had some hearings at the federal building, and in due time, I got permission to re-immigrate. And so I actually went to Detroit, left the country, and stayed overnight in Windsor, Ontario, and then walked across the bridge next day, and then got my papers stamped. That was at that point I became an immigrant, and then the 5 years started for becoming a citizen.
Mm-hmm. And how hard was it to